Well, I've been trying to get into this whole what's the deal with enterprise AI situation? Because people have been talking about it, and I use AI a lot, as everyone knows, hopefully to play Dungeons and Dragons. I've got some updates there. I'm hoping one of the conferences I submitted the talk to will accept the talk so I can give it. But I've got a lot of thoughts there.
It's an enterprise use case right there.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But I listened to the interview with is it Thomas Kurian? Is that how you say the CEO of Google? And that Ben Thompson did. It's a great interview on multiple dimensions. Like, and let me for the first dimension, I don't know if dimension or vector. Vector would be a funny pun here, I think, even though I don't really know what I'm talking about. But one, he actually goes over just like boring ass enterprise stuff to do with AI. Like, really fucking boring. But the kind of stuff that's incredibly important, like call centers or of course call centers, but also like the most boring use case that he went over that I could see is incredibly valuable, that AI would be great at, that every single organization of, I don't know, let's say 500 to 1,000 people or more is looking through, I don't even know the words, looking through your procurement records to find the merchants that you're working with, what you bought for them, and when the warranty has expired. And that was
Like
it.
it.
Okay.
And I was thinking, like, that's got to be billions of dollars a quarter, just
Yeah.
right there. Just like it's got to be magic. And so, like, I think this, I checked it in incognito mode. So you can go read the interview without having to have an account, I think. But it's just like, there you go. We're done now. We know all the enterprise use cases. Now, the second thing that was great is that guy is a master of media training. He has been through like so much good media training. And you've never been through media training, have you, Matt? You just sort of learned through osmosis.
No, I've had like, offhand media training where like marketing,
That's the
says,
best.
marketing kind of like pulls you aside and gives you some pointers about like, you shouldn't say this and try not to curse on stage. And,
Oh,
but,
yeah.
well, now that I live in Australia, I get a little more of that, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I think the only media training Matt needs is like, don't tell them this is free.
Yeah. Usually I get up on stage and I tell
Don't lead with
people,
that.
like, you don't have to pay for this stuff. You just glue it together with a couple of bash scripts.
And now I got to go file
So
some
what impressed you,
expenses.
Cote, about the in this interview? Where did the media training come through? Was it his ability
Well,
to bridge back to his core topics? Was it what
yes,
was his skill?
that was it. Now, this guy is an advanced level, so there's no way he's going to get tripped up. So that's not even a concern. That's like worrying about, like, I don't know, a long haul trucker can't back up his truck into a warehouse. It's just like that's not in the test,
Non-mission.
right? And so that's fine. But he is so masterful. Whatever question was asked, and he just like beautifully went into talking points. Now they weren't talking, and what makes it masterful, and why I'm pointing this out, I think it's great. I'm not being snarky or sarcastic about this, but he could. It's not that he ignored and redirected, but he could weave the question into a middle answer and then instantly go into like what you knew he wanted to say. And like, and now that there's two things going on there. One is the ability to do that, right? Like, there's actually three things. One's the ability to do that. Two is unlike, well, I mean, whatever. Unlike my style of doing things, he talks very slow and deliberately, as if like what he's saying, he means to say it, instead of like, my and people I know who are like me, well, who I listen to, like what we're doing is we're just not even thinking. Our mouth is just moving, and we know that we'll just go back and correct things and
That is
like
very
restate
much my
things.
style. Yes.
Right. Which like that works in the written word. In the podcast world, it kind of does, but in an interview, not good. So he's got this good the style, but then the next thing is you can tell, like so many great CEOs and kind of good tech CEOs, he
Politician.
like he just like knows his stuff. Like he like knows what the talking points are. He knows the thing. He can reel off like all these boring ass enterprise use cases then he can go back here. Also, the thing that made me pick up on it is he constantly said grounded or grounded. Right.
Oh, so, you know, which is, I didn't like that word. That was one
which
of my
is Google's new word. Yeah, and like, so word. I bet his PR people were sitting there, like, because it's got a probably remote. They were sitting there, and every time he said grounded, they were like, put one up on the board. And they're like, yep, good job.
All right, but Cote, I guess on this, though, you know, I always enjoy these interviews as well. And of course, you know, there were tons of use cases we talked about last week that they talked about at the show. But I've been thinking a lot about, like, and I was really thinking about this when I listened to Brian over at the Cloudcast this past Sunday. You know, he had the fear and excitement of learning a new era, which was sort of like, you know, lots of new things come out, right? When in this case, AI emerges, like, what should we learn? How do we know it? How do we keep learning? But the thought I had kind of after listening to this podcast was like, you know, kind of funny. It's like, well, should we even learn this? Is anything going to happen? Right. And I come to it with the idea of like, after you listen to the Thomas Kurian interview and all the other AI people evangelizing it, it's like, I had the privilege of going to here in Texas, we call what the Department of Motor Vehicles, we call it DPS, right? So I went out and was helping a family member get an ID. And of course, to get an ID for the first time, you have to kind of bring all this identification. And one of the things you have to do is establish residency. And establish residency is this weird thing. There's like 10 types of documents, probably from all told to come from like 1,000 different people, but you got to bring two of them, right? You got to bring like a bank statement or an insurance card.
Like a gas bill.
A report card, like all of this stuff. So on the face of it, it's like, it's not that hard, but it is. So when you show up at DPS, the first thing they do, they have like someone like a valet. They're like, before they even let you in, it's like, what are you here for? And let me see your documents. It's like right away, if like, I need this and you don't have the documents, they're like, you're out, go. And they're not moving that. They're just like, you got to go drive and get, you know, XYZ and this. You can't do it before they get you like behind the velvet rope to get to the actual place you're going to do. And then you have this long wait, of course. And then when you go through and you actually do it, you meet with a nice person who's like, you know, at a kiosk kind of booth, and they're doing it, right? But of course, they have to then look at every one of these documents, ascertain whether the document is actually a valid in the criteria. And they go through this convoluted process of like scanning all of this stuff in, right? Mm-hmm. Retyping your application into the computer system, uploading the scans to the system, saying who you are. Then eventually you have to take an ID. Then you have to take a thumbprint, you know, usually. And all of this is just sort of like, it's just a very manual, tedious process. And I want to say, people were very nice, right? It wasn't like, you don't want to be like, oh, people are mean. It's just like, it's just complicated. So when I sit there and I had a lot of time to think when I was just sitting around waiting, and it's like, well, this is the kind of problem where you're like, if this is real, right? If AI is real, and some of these things are not even AI, it's just maybe you're, you know, a garden variety digital transformation. But this idea that like, hey, I could scan all these forms at home, have some AI, like help the person determine like, yep, this looks right. The person's name is on it. It looks like it's from a reputable source. I've sort of pre-approved it. So when you walked in, for example, maybe you just need the person just to like look it over and just like give it the final stamp of approval. So I kind of think of all of these things when I listen to Thomas Kurian and all the other people doing it. It's like, okay, like when's this going to happen? When is that 90-minute wait at the DPS going to be like 10 minutes, right? Or the tax returns, another one we've talked a lot about here. When are the millions of tax returns that are sitting there waiting to be processed, when are they going to go faster? Because I do think sometimes, and I think this is a frustration, it's like when you see people kind of, you know, with great talking points that are well-dressed, that speak slowly and deliberately and give you great answers, it's like, okay, now that we've gone past that, I want you to come to the DPS office with me and let's sit down together. And let's talk about when is this kind of problem going to be fixed? And of course, there's millions of those ideas. So I always think kind of like, to Brian's podcast, it's like, it is exciting to learn the new things. But at the same time, it's also like, we should kind of start taking the temperature of like, are any of these problems starting to be addressed that are really like, you like to talk about this, Cote, like especially the government. The government can save people more time than almost any institution in the world. And we've talked about really good digital transformation projects in the government, but that's one. It's like, that's what I always want. When I think of watching the keynote with Thomas Kurian, it's like, I wish he was here. He was with me today and be like, how long do you think before we don't have to sit here and wait for this line?
Yeah. I, you know, that seems like a perfect application for all this yeah. stuff. And not, you know, as far as when it would happen, like who, yeah, you're right. Who knows? It's like, there is no, I feel like, I don't know, is this a cynical take? I feel like maybe in my whole racket here of digital transformation, it's just like randomly happens. There's really no, it's just like stuff happens. It might be like, yeah. It might be the Planck principle comes into effect. It might be like some new C whatever comes in. Who knows? But it could happen. Now that said, maybe you two know all the terminology, but like as you're going, I haven't thought about how you what's the word? I get my A's mixed up. How you authenticate yourself to the government. But I feel like that might be one of the shoddiest chains of trust ever, that you bring in a gas bill and like maybe a statement from a bank, and then they're like, yep, now you're a citizen of Texas. Here's a driver's license. Enjoy the rest of authorized access to the entire United States. And then that's it. You're done.
But I do, like, you know, I thought a lot about that too. And I think this is just maybe this is like a first principle questions, but it's like, all right, like you are a resident of Texas. Like you've been living here. Let's assume that you're actually done everything correctly. And it's like, well, in this case, the DPS, they have to basically say you are. But like before you can get an ID, like they have to decide something, right? So it is kind of amazing. They're just like, well, we're looking for documents that like you've been here for a while, right? And that's why they just, because it was like a fishing license, a hunting license, a report
card, fishing license,
a bank statement, a report card, and then just like all these things, because there isn't any like, because it's kind of it literally is the chicken or egg problem. It's like, well, like I just kind of like, I think you've been here, but like, can you bring some stuff in? Even though all of these things, like when you go get many of these documents, they ask for no ID. They just issue it to you. It's like, you just say like
a hunting license.
Yeah. You're just like, especially a fishing license, just go to any local, mostly sporting goods stores. Just be like, I want a fishing license. Some person behind the counter will, it probably take 10 minutes. Right. And like, they don't ask anything. They're just like, okay, good luck. In fact, they give you tips on how to fish. That's all you get at the end, right? There is no identity verification. So it's funny. Then you then take that to the official government. And they're like, looks like it's good, man. You've got this fishing license. So we're going to give you the
document. And then they turn around and they're like, you know, do you have any utility bills? And you're like, yeah, they're all digital. And they're like, that's okay. So then you just go and you randomly download some, you know, content off the internet.
Yep.
And, you know, do you want to edit that? Sure. And then you just print it out and they're like, looks legit. And, you know, you've built this chain of trust that is completely, you know, your hunting license with a forged utility bill. And now you can open a banking account with a $50,000 overdraw protection. I'm not saying like, you know, the vector for attack is not just already well known, but it's already well known. I mean, this harkens back to the XZ attack, that, you know, all the security companies were like, hey, you know, if somebody went after a, you know, overstressed maintainer, or, you know, forged a chain of trust of maintainers for software, they could do an attack this way. And then sure enough, here we are, it's happened. And people are like, nobody saw this coming. I mean, banking already has this problem with fake people opening fake accounts, laundering a little bit of credit for a while, and then just, you know, blowing open wide accounts. Now with AI, we can just automate the whole thing.
So Matt, as you were saying that, I feel like we need to redraw the XKCD diagram, you know, the one that's kind of famous for like the open sources.
Yeah,
like,
the guy in Nebraska.
And, like, maybe we should do that for like identification. At the bottom, there's just one person
at an
academy that's issuing a fishing license. And then it goes up and up and up. And it's like, yeah, at the end, there's like someone's like authenticating like a $7 billion trade. And it's built on all. It all started with this one person. It's like, hey, the fish are biting. Good luck. You know, that was the only thing that was left.
Turns out it's fish with a pH.
Well, I think what we need to do, you know, there's been some talk in the Slack channel about actually launching Legacy Conf. And I think one of the special sessions we're going to have, maybe the afternoon keynote, is what we're going to do. We're going to have get some, I don't know, maybe state or county CIOs. And we're going to put them like all in dark and use that like kidnapper voice modulator.
Yeah.
And then we're going to interview them. And we're just going to be the title of the session is going to be state, local, education, government. What the fuck? And it's just going to like say like what's going on here? Like why? Yes.
And then in the voice modulation, they're going to be like, I put Java 1.3 in production in 2024.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be exactly like that. And maybe I'll if I can get around to it as kind of a control case, I'll get someone from like a Dutch city government to come and they'll come over, and every answer will just be like, yeah, we don't have that problem.
Exactly.
We've got a central ID system, and the computers they all work.
Except
for, I have to say, paying to throw away trash here in Dauvendrecht, we've got some ludicrous Belgian trash control company, and you can only pay. You have to use these little cards to scan on the trash. Oh. Man, I feel like I shouldn't get started because you know
I'm fishing license.
I enjoy
and
being
get some
a
more
guest
cards.
Here.
That's right. Get it done.
My only suggestion. Is that I think just as a suggestion for improvement, people love giving free advice in this part of the world, is that I would like to be able to put more than 10 euros on the card at once.
$200
whatever, because I got you know 5 kids to feed, I got a shit ton of trash, and like I'm always throwing shit out, and nothing's worse than walking down to the end of the street with a shit ton of trash, and then the card's like, nope.
There's no like auto top up.
Nope.
Wow. Brutal. That is brutal, Kote. You need to get on that one for sure.
Yeah. They really don't want you to throw your trash away.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe this is like some kind of continental European American like social difference where they're just like, you know, have less trash. Have you tried that?
Conserve more.
Yeah. Just plan.
Reuse.
Yeah. Well, speaking of nothing related to that, I think
speaking of more trash,
I think it appears there was I don't know, I'm not a code forensicist, a Quincy code D or anything, but
the BS
like
code proctologist, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. But it seems like there was some conclusory sort of findings in the Hashi Open Tofu Terraforma situation. What's going on there, Matt Ray? You know how to use Git and PRs and stuff.
Well, you know, as we talked about it on the show last week, the Open Tofu project had been accused of taking code from Hashi's Terraform project post license change, and you know the there was the Matt Essay article that implied that the Open Tofu maintainers were cribbing off of Terraform's code, and the Open Tofu folks showed their receipts. You know, they came to play with literally like a 50-page PDF where they went like line by line showing code with Git commits and where it came from, and they showed pretty much. I mean, I talked with some folks who knew a little more about it, and this was not a cheap venture. This wasn't just like a developer hacked something away in an hour or two. This was, a substantial investment of time and money to prove that the code was not taken, post BSL license change. And it's pretty much an open and shut case as far as like anyone who understands technology is concerned. But it's probably not over.
And I think it's worth maybe just calling out, what at the end of the day, as the long analysis talks about, it says, Alta says here, quote, the code in question can clearly be shown to have been copied from older code under the MPL 2.0 license. And then it goes on to say, HashiCorp seems to have copied the same code itself when they implemented their version of this feature. So I just think this is like, a practice as old as time in software engineering. It's like, I need to update this. This is pretty similar. I'll just, and it's funny that it looks like both independently, I would assume, but doing the obvious thing, both groups basically started with the same base file, and then it made. And that's sort of, I think, accounts for like where there are similarities, it's because they started with the same file. And where there are differences, it's clearly that they went in and did a slightly different implementation. So, I mean, to me, the whole thing, and I think we should say it's like, you know, while we don't know exactly how much time and cost went into this, I mean, this document is substantial. So, like, I think we can safely say thousands of dollars were spent doing this, right? I mean, I think that's maybe like, and certainly an incredible amount of time and effort. So I guess we just kind of return to the original question. And then I guess I come back to, after saying all this, you know, Matt Essay, after like causing all of this, you know, thousands of dollars of work and things like that, Matt Essay responds with like, in my opinion, a pretty feeble response. He just says something along the lines of like, quote, been waiting for this to publish. He says, this answers my concerns, and I appreciate how thoughtful, fair, and kind it is. I was hasty in my judgment, and I'm grateful for the generous reply. And it just seems like, wow. So it probably took you like, I don't know, 5 minutes to write that tweet after generating all of this controversy. So I think people online, you know, seem pretty, you know, obviously it's one of these things, like, I don't want to overstate, you know, the importance of this, but at the same time, it just seemed, I kind of felt like his whole response was inadequate, right? And the whole thing just, you know, seems to just reek of like, I have just so many questions. And I guess the key questions I would ask Matt Essay would just be like, where did the idea of this article originally come from, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how did he figure about it, right? Did he attempt to ask the OpenTofu team about this at all before the publication? And then just for those at home, right? Remember, Matt is a well-known person in the industry, and he's also now the VP of Developer Relations at Mongo. So I think it's very safe to say that he could have easily reached out to this group. I think he has plenty of contacts.
Yep.
And then finally, it's like, you know, just in his, while it doesn't directly affect MongoDB, I would just ask him, because he's had other positions like this in other companies. It's just like, you know, does he see writing articles like this? Like, is this helpful for like someone who's a VP of developer relations? And I'll just add there is like, I just think if you were to distill developer relations down to anything, it's sort of maintaining lines of communication between developers, whether they work for your company directly, they are partners of yours, or they are open source in the larger community. So it seems like a core tenet of that job, and Matt, you've sort of maybe done more of this than I have, it's sort of just, you know, keeping lines of communication open, which seems to be the exact opposite of everything that was done here. So,
yeah,
you know, again, the entire thing like makes me sort of just, and then, you know, if you want to like a little bit more strong take, you know, Adam Jacob, who continues on his streak of being mentioned on this podcast, I guess we're just going to have the token Adam Jacob thing. And he wrote this on Twitter, and I thought it was pretty good because it summarizes a lot of my thoughts as well. It says, quote, this was about injecting FUD, so that's fear, uncertainty, and doubt, into the market and not wanting a trusted open source alternative to Terraform that's such a direct competitor to exist. HashiCorp wins even if the allegations are false because the allegations are public. So, you know, that rings true to me, right? That this is something that's sort of like another way to put out FUD that really isn't helping anyone in the industry. So, but again, you know, I don't want to speak for Matt Essay. I don't know what he did, you know, but I think given he's a columnist, and Cote, you've brought this up before, it's like columnists are often looking for things to write about. This seems like it would be a really good subject for one of his future articles. So I know, Cote, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, it is like, you know, odd if it, you know, let me restate what you were saying, Matt. So you have one piece of code, yep, that, and didn't this piece of code like remove something or rename something? I don't remember.
The code was for a new piece of remove syntax.
Yeah, so, and it, so, it yeah, seemed like
it wasn't a removal of code, but it was an action called remove.
It seemed also like it was like 15 lines of code or something.
It was a little more than that. But it was not as they kind of point out in the forensics. It's like this was not like a brand new idea. This was, you know, a modification of other existing patterns in the code. So of course it's going to look like a lot of existing stuff.
And so what you're saying is before the forking, when everything was cool, we'll call it the everything cool zone. there was this chunk of code that anyone could do whatever they wanted with. Because it was everything cool zone. And then you have the, we don't want the public clouds to steal our money, relicensing. And then still the same code, but you got the old code that was in the previous license. So then they got to update this piece of code to do whatever it does. and you've got the open tofu people, and then you got the Terraform people, the mm-hmm. HashiCorp people, and they both took that same piece of code and probably made some minor modifications
yep.
to make it do the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were similar because they're not exactly the same, right?
Right.
Like if you were to run, do people still use hashes? If you were to like yes. hash them, it wouldn't be exactly the same code.
No, absolutely not.
No way.
And it's even different characters.
Yeah, it's substantially more different than that even. Yeah.
So what it seems like is like, I mean, it is odd that, I mean, you wouldn't just like look at the version control and be like,
that's in the forensics is they track, you know, the commits back to the sources and they're like, look, here's where it came from. It's not, I mean, the problem is it's a waste of time, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, you've got, cause now as you know, it's been pointed out, you know, the HashiCorp can say, well, you know, those guys infringe on our code and it, you know, nobody goes back and reads the fact that InfoWorld article or whatever, wherever it was, you know, put a little header on it because we read it and we don't go back to reread things, you know? So
yeah,
it's like, it's out there, you know, these allegations are out there and, you know, nobody, you can't, you know, you can't.
It's kind of like, I don't think we covered this, but that, well, we covered the first thing, but you know, the thing that like the Amazon no checkout was just like 1,000 people in India. And then there was some follow up that was like, actually, they were just doing verification of the machine learning stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't really doing that. Like, I don't, probably everyone's just going to be like, oh, now it's all Mechanical Turk.
Now
stuff
it's all Mechanical Turk
for the rest of time. So that, yeah, I don't know. It does like, it does seem very,
I think, strange. You know, intent to me, to your point there, Cote, is really important. It's like, I think the Amazon article, it's like, you know, people can make mistakes. Like you could read that. And I think I understand why people would have inferred like, oh, this is all just kind of fake. It's all things like that. And then later on, you know, it's like, I think people are just sort of like, you know, making an honest error, right? In that kind of situation, right? But who knows? Maybe we'd have to go back and look at it. But in this case, right? I mean, this article, right, is just comes out and directly says you stole this, right? And it's like, what is the good faith, you know, what good faith response or, you know, information is Matt Assay putting out there, right? I mean, it just doesn't, like, what is the intent? Like, this doesn't feel like just an honest mistake, right? This feels like, you know, because again, like, where did he get all these ideas? Where did he go through all this code? You know, if he went through all this analysis, where's his analysis? Like, why, you know, again, it's just sort of like, if you're just going out and you're really just accusing somebody of mm-hmm. something, like, you got to be, you know, that's a lot different than like, oh, I read the thing about Amazon and I just interpreted it to mean nothing else. It's like, okay, that's an honest mistake.
I mean, that's why, you know, real reporters always say, you know, we reached out to, you know, so-and-so and they declined to comment, or, you know, or they did comment, right? And instead we're just like, we only get one side of a story and it's a story.
So it'll be fun. So I guess we'll have to watch it. I think, you know, I don't know. I don't know if we could, you know, again, in the risk of like trying to be a real reporter, I guess, I think it feels like we may hear more on this subject. I guess
sure.
I don't think it's quite over. I think maybe this little part is over, but I guess we'll have to watch to see what Hashi and OpenTofu do next. Like see what the next, whether that's a legal thing or code thing or something like that. It feels like more to come on this for sure.
Just, you know, that they need some AI to like look at all the code bases and do some analysis and generate what is it, GraphViz or something, just to make some visualizations, dump it all out into some JSON, and then you get another AI that's like a lawyer, point counterpoint and things like that, and then we could just resolve all of it. It would be great.
Well, I mean, and this just gives Hashi, you know, time to you know, make more, you know, to put fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the minds of, you know, potential OpenTofu users. They're like, oh, do I, you know, is this code going to go away? Can I trust it? You know, it's...
Oh, yeah. This is like
this is the old Microsoft play.
Yeah. You remember this, Matt, back in the 90s where people said that tofu would cause boys to grow breasts? Like, this is something that came up quite frequently.
More
FUD.
I mean, you know, that one probably got left on the HashiCorp marketing floor.
We'll make this accusation.
Well, speaking of words that rhyme with accusation, that I just made up a word there. Is it a rumor or a confirmed thing? It looks like our Salesforce friends are going to buy Informatica, and I think this would create I don't know, like, what would this create? Is this some sort of like data integration powerhouse here? You got Mule. Remember those guys? They were fun.
Yeah, they're fun.
I'm sure I told the story over the 10 or so years of this podcast, but I went to an early Mule Source conference. And I think maybe I spoke there or something. Maybe there's just extra swag, but they actually gave me a little box that had cufflinks with a little mule on it. And
nice.
I might still have those somewhere. I'll have to see.
I actually gave a talk with MuleSoft here at the Open Source Summit.
And then later on in my life, when I was living in Amsterdam, I was dropping the kids off at school. And I look over, and who's standing there but Dave Rosenberg, the first CEO of MuleSource, and also played in the band Dead Guy, I believe. And so wow. He was right there. And, you know.
Small world.
Yeah. Anyhow, Informatica. You know, I remember, I think when I was an analyst or doing M&A a long time ago, because I did a big analysis of, what did we used to call it? Business intelligence and big data?
Yeah.
BIBD. Remember big data when data was oil? Yeah. Informatica, they've been around for a while. I had to go look it up. They aren't one of these companies like Progress who's bought like all these different things that are unrelated. I think they just do data. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Or did they, whatever happened to Perforce? Pervasive? What was the Austin database? Yeah,
another one. Pervasive, yeah, software. There was another database company as well. Well, yeah. I was thinking this one, I don't know, you know, I don't want to oversimplify it, but it looks like it's like going to be about a $10 billion acquisition. So for a company like Salesforce, fairly small, and it's sort of, you know, what's your, what is it? String of pearls, Kote? Is that the correct M&A term?
You know, right? let me think if the,
does that apply, right?
Yeah, it's hard. You know,
they bought MuleSoft, they've bought Slack, they've bought, I'm forgetting a couple of others. So it feels like, Heroku, another one, but it definitely feels like along the
that's more like a string of some stuff you bought in the Southwest, just unrelated rocks that put together
the string of rocks you got in West Texas, maybe. So
the string of pearls theory is generally that they're all pearls, they're all the same rock. Mm-hmm. and like you put them together instead of being in different all categories,
right. All right. Well, it just, I don't know, to me, it just feels like more simple. It's just like, well, Salesforce wants to grow. It's hard to grow organically. And this is like just, you know, kind of part of their long. And again, this, I mean, it's always funny because like every new entrant sort of like, you know, sort of, if you will, pits itself against something. So obviously Oracle was the quote unquote, if you will, enemy to Salesforce that they kind of overcame. But of course, this is like what Oracle and IBM and many other companies do all the time. It's like once you get to a certain size, you know, it just, you start acquiring these things and you look a little bit more like private equity, right? And through inorganic growth than you do like an innovative product company. So I think it's probably good. Maybe it's good for the Informatica people. I don't know if it, like Tableau was the other one, right? I was thinking if they bought that one as well, right?
Yeah.
So it just seems like, I guess, in their portfolio of all the things Salesforce could do, it's fine, but it just becomes another very large enterprise company aggregating lots of enterprise functionality. So probably good for Wall Street, good for the numbers. I don't know if it, you know, ultimately if it, you know, it just feels like the companies that are really successful, we talk about it, like grow organically bigger. So maybe this is just a sign Salesforce is like, if you will, hit its ceiling through organic growth.
Well, you know, I wonder with Salesforce when I see acquisition stuff, like they don't seem to acquire like CRM or sales related things. Now, tangentially, of course, like you got to do reporting, you got to like suck all this data in, like all that kind of stuff. But like, it's making me wonder, like, if maybe one of two things, like maybe there just is no more advancement in CRM, so you wouldn't buy any more things. I mean, you know, it seems like the only big deal in CRM is like the UI could be better. is like what would be nice. And then sure, you could like mess around with the data more and apply AI and things like that. But like, I guess there's not like any CRM companies you would acquire. Like, it's not like in the infrastructure business where like all the time, like if you're a Cisco, whoever else acquires things. Do the big cloud companies acquire companies? They seem to have a pretty small track record. They don't buy gigantic things. I guess not generally. Google bought Apigee, right? Like,
yeah.
That seemed big.
I mean, yeah, Google's bought a handful of monitoring startups and you know, automations, you know, pieces. Yeah. And Microsoft, you know, they've bought they bought, you know, a couple of things related to Kubernetes.
I guess they got GitHub, but yeah, but that's not yeah, like
they bought GitHub.
But you know, in the infrastructure space, you're always like buying stuff up, right?
Yeah.
Like you're always like refreshing the portfolio, but maybe in the ERP and CRM space, not so much. So that could be one theory of like, why would you buy Informatica when you could buy a cool new CRM thing, right? Instead. And then another one, maybe this is an instance of like, well, we can't because then the DOJ is going to come knock on our door.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like we're already like king. I mean, it's right. It's our name. We're already a big force in the sales world. And so like we can't really get more market share. That's a little too risky. So now we got to go just like,
well, they're
dick around in ETL or something.
Like, they're enriching their data sources, right? They're finding more ways to pump more value into their, you know, CRM thing. I mean,
but even as you say it, I just my eyes start to roll. It's
of
like,
of course,
wow,
they do, but it's
more data topic. Lost in Salesforce that I'll never be able to find. You know, well, what I mean?
Maybe like, AI can find it.
I don't know. It's like, you know, it's almost like as soon as you finish with the Salesforce person, they give you the Tableau stuff. Now that all the data is in Salesforce, what you're going to need is another tool that maybe you can download and export to CSV, and you can, if your Excel isn't working, you can try to use Tableau. So I don't know, but I do think, you know, I guess when you kind of think about Salesforce just in general, I think you hit it right on, Cote, about like, I think one, the DOG, if they tried to roll up CRM, I'm sure the DOG would get involved. But two, unlike monitoring and systems management and observability, you know, it seems like there just aren't as many of those. Maybe it's just because it's outside the development community. Because there are, it feels, someone said this on a different podcast, so I
yeah.
remember what, saying something like, it feels like I know, with all due respect to charity majors, like I'm going to lump observability and monitoring together. So, but I'm just saying that it feels like the market supports about like 50 companies at any one time. There can be like 50 different monitoring companies, some making a ton of money, but they're somehow sustaining, but they're not like 50 CRM companies. They just like, you know what I mean? Like people don't want to work on CRM or like there isn't like, cause I think there's always a new generation of developers like, you know what we need to do? We need to come up with a better way to write monitoring. And it's just like, whereas I don't think anyone's like, know what we need to do? Write a new CRM tool. Everyone's like, no, just use Salesforce.
Yeah,
that's all you need to do.
New monitoring solutions come because what you're monitoring is changing. Like CRM, you're still just selling to customers. There's nothing changes about it.
Doesn't change that much.
I mean, despite the business section of, you know, the bookstore is like, it's still the same story over and over again, right? Yeah.
It is incredible though. Like no matter what happens, it's like the data is always in Salesforce and not available to you. No matter what, no matter how, I'm sure if I am anything to predict that in a year from now, the data, they'll have more data in there that will be lost to me that I will not be able to see. So I look forward to that. I look forward to the Informatica data now officially being behind the Salesforce wall and not available to me.
With new APIs.
new APIs. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think we mentioned this briefly last episode, just in passing, but also I think worth going over. Speaking of infrastructure, there's like a collection of market sizing numbers that I came across. You know, I always love that. There's two numbers that I always want to know in the Kubernetes market. One of them is how many applications or workloads globally are running on Kubernetes. I'm always curious about that. It's difficult. You know, I haven't seen something new for maybe, what is this, 2024? Maybe a year and a half. But every now and then, I love it when Gartner does this. Every now and then they have a press release on something else and they let slip a good little nugget. This is why they, now that I think of it, they might do this just so that you read, like, you know, what's the one they have, Brandon? Like the hot startups or something?
Mm-hmm. Like cool vendors. Cool vendors.
Yeah, just report. Like some kind of throwaway reports. We're just like, yep, cool vendors.
Lead gen reports. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. But every now and then they'll be like, you know, in some unrelated thing, they'll just like in passing be like, oh, this is a Kubernetes product or market that's you know, there's this many applications running there. So they'll in passing they'll say these numbers. So I forget where it was, but I don't know. They have an estimate of like, depending on how you do the math in your head, whatever that means, like 15%, let's say, of workloads globally run on Kubernetes, which I guess I don't know. I don't even know how to like fathom that. But market sizing is the other fun thing to know. And this is where things get crazy is like, I think I have mentioned this before, but I didn't really get y'all's take on it so much is like there's IDC. They have a forecast that the I don't think they call it the Kubernetes market, because of course they're being academically responsible. They call it something like, you know, the container orchestration and runtime market for open source projects that begin with K. I think is what they call this category. And they put it at like 5.56 billion by 2027, right? Which that would definitely help repairs at Matt and I's rent houses back in Austin if we had that amount of money. And then you got the 451, they put it at 2.85 billion in 2028. So I don't know, we lost around $3 billion somewhere.
There's some layoffs.
Yeah, there you go. But then, and you know, the CNCF at the I almost said factory there at KubeCon, they have a broader market. I think their market is everything that's in the landscape, which is fine.
Oof, yeah.
But they put that bigger, much bigger market at $2.3 trillion worldwide. By 2029, up from $547 billion in 2022, and so we got a lot of numbers going on there. And I think my theory is that the CNCF assumptions are computers, like software.
Computers that touch our landscape. Yeah,
and which
do you think? I guess you know, these numbers are so big, and it is kind of hard to get your head around some of them. But I guess if someone just asked me, my qualitative take on the whole thing is like, well, containers, it's not going, it's, they're not being adopted as fast as people once thought. Like, that's what I would say. Like, I don't know if this number is right or the other one is right. It just feels like there's still just like the thing I say all the time. It's like, yep, I still see a lot of VMware and a lot of servers running there. And I feel like
yeah,
those workloads, I don't think they're coming. I don't think they're coming to the container world.
So I think that is one possible very valid take, right? The other one that my mind goes to is that is like, you know, so if you do a bottoms up, I think this is the right term. I only worked on this kind of market sizing for like 2 months when I was at 451. Probably not even 2 months, probably like 2.5 days total clock time when I would talk with people. But like, you know, if you did a bottoms up analysis, you're like, okay, what can I even pay for? Right. Like what is the Kubernetes I can pay for that would be core Kubernetes? And like maybe not much. Right. Like I guess you could pay for like metered public cloud Kubernetes. I don't even know how they bill for that, but I assume they just bill for like if you just wanted to, you know, my old joke is that like Kubernetes is a really cool blinking cursor machine. Right. Like if you just wanted to like install Kubernetes and have a blinking cursor ready to go, I assume you can pay for that with the public clouds, right? It's not like serverless.
Absolutely. So you can just Matt can help you out. Matt can tell you exactly what you're paying for that.
So you would put that in there, right? And then you would have licenses or subscriptions, whatever we call it nowadays. You would have licenses, subscriptions for like stuff like we sell at VMware and Rancher,
Red Hat, Tanzu, all that Hat, stuff.
Right? And so you'd throw that in there. And that's it.
And a bunch of little startups, they're doing something, you know,
tiny
little companies doing stuff.
Right. But like, it makes me think like, maybe Kubernetes is also so free and so cheap that like, you don't pay for it directly. Like you pay for, or I don't know. There is something weird. It's one of those two options. Or there's the other option. I was reading, the old John Gruber. And he, of course, IDC came out with some other numbers showing that like Samsung was number one smartphones and Apple dropped. And he was like, oh, pew, pew, pew. And he was like, IDC put the numbers at this. And in parentheses, he was like, you know, dubious at best. And it's like, come on, we got it. IDC is fine. You don't go from your consumer space stuff and make fun of our enterprise nonsense. We know what we're doing over here. But, you know, the estimates could be a little wonky, too.
Gruber, like, again, it's more a qualitative take. It's like whatever the estimates say, you just know, you just kind of know intuitively. It's like, wow, the iPhone is a really strong and a great business and it's doing great. Right. I mean, it doesn't matter. Like IDC can say whatever they want. We're like, that's kind of the model. And it's kind of like this. It's like, I think all the things you said about Kubernetes are true. It's great and all everything. I agree with everything you said. At the same time, I'm also like, well, when I talk to these people, I'm like, hey, show me your VMware console. Like, show me the workloads in there. And it's just like, there's a lot.
There,
what you're doing on Kubernetes, it's like, well, we got a couple small projects. We got this one thing that's running in production. It's a lot less, right? And now that when I say that, I'm always kind of taking out the hyperscalers. Yes, the Googles, the Facebooks, like they're doing at a massive scale. But everyone else, I feel like, is more like, yeah, we're going to get to it. Like,
yeah. You know, real enterprises. Yeah.
We're going to get to it eventually, but it's not right now. So.
Yeah. I talked with a couple of people recently about like the Kubernetes CNCF world. And it seems like, I mean, they have, I think in the next few years, they're going to have to do a good job, like, you know, managing the journey to the plateau of productivity, which like the OpenStack people didn't do too well. Well, let me rephrase that. Maybe they did it well and it just didn't work out well, so to speak. Right. And so like, whereas nowadays there is like, I don't know, maybe it's just because I've been getting a lot of emails from them, but like, I think they're okay. Like they figured out, OpenStack has figured out their deal and it's fine. Right. But like, it was quite the ski down that slope from expectations there. And like, there is like, there's some way you could ride that out better, right? Where to make sure that everything works out well. And like something like this is a good example of like, it'd be good to spot this and be like, what the fuck's going on here? Right? Like we're up on stage talking about 2.3 trillion. And then these 451 people are like 2.85. And so like, there's some kind of, I don't know, something weird happening there.
Now I will say this though, to maybe, you know, be a little bit more positive of the future of Kubernetes. Like I did see this, and it was Goldman Sachs discusses the virtues of Kubernetes for virtual machine management. I think they were using OpenShift, and I think this happened at KubeCon. So I think anyone can go. It was the event in Paris. I think you can go watch it online. And I was like, it was an incredibly boring use case, and I loved every minute of it. I was like, yeah, this is like, now we're talking. We can get like, let's just get all this stuff.
The Cooper, right. And like that's more of the that was my well, not that, but it's making me think additional wording for my second scenario there, which is like, it's just that, like, it'd be cool if I knew this off the top of my head, but like probably like the total Linux market is not huge, right? Like just paying straight up support for,
yeah,
right. Like, and you know, interestingly, like because when you get Linux in a public cloud, you're not really paying for Linux unless you opt for supported Linux, but you can just sort of like get it, right? Like it's embedded in another thing, right? And it seems like one very possible path for Kubernetes to go. And this was like, you know, shout out to our friend Brian, my favorite documentary of all time, apparently, the Kubernetes documentary. Like if you look at the beginning of the Kubernetes documentary, they're basically like, yeah, we had to like not let Amazon dominate, right? And so how do you do that? You come up with a free open source thing that's great, or that's good enough, and it's free. And so like you could have a technology here, as so many technologies are, Brandon and I's favorite, how much of a market TAM is in SNMP? Very little, right? You could have like a critical part of the infrastructure of how the world runs that actually doesn't have a TAM worth snorting at.
No, totally right. And I do. And I think, you know, what I like about this presentation, because it was boring in a good way, it was like there wasn't like the culture talk. It wasn't like the 12 steps of decomposing a monolith. It was just like, hey, like we have all these VMs and we had to do it, and we're doing it this way, and we're using kubevert, and I don't know if all this works. I mean, but the presentation was good, and like, you know, it seemed like they were just telling a really simple story. And I was like, and to your point, Cote, it's like, okay, people see that and people start doing this, right? They're just like, hey, we can just get all our VMs running in here. It's like, okay, you could see a lot of adoption that way. And then maybe down the road, you know, for the new workloads, maybe that is the more cloud native approach to building apps. But that's the future, right? But you don't have to like, you know, to get there, you don't have to like do everything new. You could still like, you know, live in your world of VMs, which I think they're just going to be here for a long time.
It's an easier lift and shift.
I was getting really excited when you're going through that Goldman thing and you said, you know, does this work? I don't know. And I thought that was in the presentation. And the Goldman person was just going to be like, I don't know, but it's hella cheap.
Now the Goldman person is very complimentary, which is good. I would assume they're up there. Now, Matt, you were, I think we were commenting before the show. It's like, hey, when you get the customers up, they're talking, right? They're usually, I mean, the funny thing about a customer presentation is like, it's usually like really boring, very pragmatic, and probably the best thing you need to hear at a conference. You know what I mean?
For sure.
Yeah. It's just like, yeah, it's like, you're probably not going to like watch. There's no like, you know, animated stuff. And he's not the person giving it isn't super media trained. They're just like, yeah, we did this. And then we did this. And then, yeah, it works. And everybody was happy. And then they never say this part, but then, you know what I did? I went home on Friday and I played with my kids. And then we went to like baseball game and it was fun. And that was like, that's the end of the story. Right. And it's like, awesome. That's exactly what you want to hear. Right.
Yeah.
You
know? And now every other enterprise is like, I like my kids.
Yeah. I want to go to the baseball game. I want to eat the hot dogs.
Yeah. You know, can I just give a little professional's notes on customer keynote presentations? You know, whatever, as far as a disclaimer, but like, we don't need to hear about the values of your company. We just want to hear what Brandon went over. Like, it's a tech conference. You don't got to like roll some video. I know your comms people are like probably making you do it, but just like, at least if you're up on stage and you're doing the whole, like, you got the sports jacket with no tie situation, like maybe just kind of like after it plays, be just kind of like, you know, you got to give a little signal of like, pretty awesome, right? Now let's talk about computers.
Well, I would go one step further. I think the ones that do the best is they don't talk about their corporate values and what they're doing, is they just reveal some crazy fact about their company that nobody knew. They're like, turns out we make every hot dog for Costco and it's 7 billion hot dogs here. And you're like, oh my God, I had no idea.
That's
the
good.
The only thing you should do is just reveal the crazy thing about your company that nobody knows. Right.
I like that
a lot.
And then you go into the thing and at the end you say, hey, if you want to come talk more about what we do.
Yeah, well, that's good.
I mean, Goldman and the like have done that when they're like, it turns out we have 50,000 software developers. You're like, wait, what?
Yeah. Well, I love the shipping companies are always incredible. It's like, yeah, turns out everything in the world runs through this one shipping port and you didn't know it. And you're like, whoa, okay, that was good to know.
Yeah. So,
lots of good stuff, though. But yeah, you're right. Don't do the values. Just do your fun fact. Fun fact, yeah. And then tell us how you are running all your workloads in some new virtualization platform. That's what we want to hear. And then, and then of course, at the end, put a picture of your kids in. Be like, and at the end of the day, I spent time with the family. That was it.
Those are nice. Yeah. If you find that part of your presentation is a video of some sort of organic matter or plants blowing in the wind that's been slowed down, just axe that part. You don't need it.
Nobody needs that.
Yeah. Not good. Well, do we have any bureaucracy this episode, Brandon?
Let's see here. So a few pieces of feedback came in this week. So I guess condolences to Craig Box. His under sink soap dispenser fell off and soap went over his bathroom floor. But just to be clear, he was not using what I'm officially designating the software-defined talk official endless soap dispenser. That's we talked about on the previous episode. So that's a failure for him to upgrade, I think, is
what on there. Oh, so don't blame the user.
And then Jason recommends the grip case for the Nintendo Switch Lite. He says, quote, it helps my hands not get fatigued as I play and is a lot more comfortable. So there you go. So if you have problems with soap or you want to play, you're getting some, what is the wrist thing, RSI issues with your Switch, I've got solutions for you. And then finally, Cote, maybe you can shed some more life. Previous guests, I think also one of your coworkers, Andrew Schaefer, evidently owns an All-American Burger. So I don't know. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I heard from someone that he had a burger shop, and I DM'd with I got it confused. I thought it was a pizza place. I asked Andrew and he said it was a burger place. And so but then like a lot of my correspondence, that was the end of the conversation.
All right, well, can we reveal the location?
However, he lives in Tucson. So I did a little bit of, I went back and watched all seasons of Veronica Mars so I could figure out how to be a private investigator. I loaded up the CD-ROM and I just searched for like Tucson, like burgers or something. I forget how I found it. But yeah, you can find in Yelp and somewhere else. And it's the All-American Burger. And I think it's in a mall somewhere in Tucson. And you know, he's got a great little overview that he likes good food and he likes people and he's bringing them together with the burgers and they look good.
Yeah.
So next time I'm in Tucson, I'm gonna have to go to All American Burgers.
Yeah. All right. Well, the homework assignment then is, I guess we're gonna need a listener in Tucson. I know there's a few of you out there, right? Please go have an All American Burger at this restaurant and send in some type of review. As everyone knows, the tech ads have dried up. So at this point, we're going full on. We're going food. Last week was coffee. No one's like, let me know. Did someone get the coffee? And someone owes us a review of that. And now someone needs to go eat the, I would assume it would be the cheeseburger, but I'll let you decide when you're there. You order what you want and tell us. Actually, I would like to know if they have a milkshake too. That would also be.
I think I saw that.
I think they do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel like that would be real. That's like an all-American thing. Burger, fries, milkshake. But please email us at you can just put questions at softwaredefinedtalk.com or put it in Slack. Let us know your review. And then finally, if you like a sticker, all you have to do is send your postal address to stickers@softwaredefinedtalk.com. And I will be happy to send you a sticker anywhere in the world.
Well, there's also some conferences. Now, if you're watching this live stream or maybe if you get it really early tomorrow morning, you might have the chance to go. Well, not even tomorrow morning. I'm getting my days mixed up. If you watch the live stream, you can go to the Open Source Summit North America, where Matt Ray is. That's April 16th and 18th, which is probably in the past if you're listening to it now. So go next year.
Move fast.
Yeah, I think it's a good conference, right, Matt?
Yeah, having a good time.
Yeah, it's good stuff. There's also, I'm going to be speaking at NDC Oslo on June 12th. That's in Oslo. And I'm also speaking at DevOps Days Amsterdam, June 19th to 21st. And there's also DevOps Days Birmingham, Alabama, August 19th and 21st. I think there's some other conference I'm speaking at, but I don't have it here in my notes. But don't worry. If you're someone involved in that conference, I have it in my other silo of responsibility. That I always like to freak out, not like to, but I've realized over the years, you guys have worked with the event organizers, the operations people who make shit happen. And like, I have this habit that Kim, my wife, really dislikes, where I will ask her to like quadruple verify facts, right? Like just things. And she's just like, I've told you this 5 times. And I just want to be like, I know, but like, I also save my file like 15 times a minute. Like, it's just like, I like to have all these checksums and verifications, but like, I realized with all these operations and event people, every time you have a phone call with them, you don't want to be like, and this is on June 19th. Like they freak the fuck out. So you gotta not ask them that. Well, speaking of freaking the fuck out, Brandon, do you have any recommendations this episode?
I do. I've got two things. I think, Matt, you also listened to this as well, but this is the podcast over at Oxide. And they did a very detailed interview with the person that found the XZ backdoor.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess it's Andres. I don't know how to say his last name. But I'll be honest, it's one of these things, like, it is very low level. So, like, just no going in that this is a pretty dense interview.
Yeah.
But I thought it was excellent. Kind of back to, like, we were talking about earlier about, you know, things get aggregated and the New York Times writes about it. And they actually even talk about how the New York Times interviewed Andres and, like, basically got a lot of it wrong. But like, so it turns out the whole story is fascinating. And it turns out Andreas is like, he's into the micro optimizations of like Postgres,
right,
which has sort of like led him down the path to discover this. And then just like the whole story is, it is like, if you're into technology and if you can kind of get through, because there's a lot of technical details, but I think it is really, really a good interview. And anyone in technology is sort of like, you know, just kind of interested in like how these bugs get figured out and some of the details, the very low level details that go on. It's a good lesson, but be prepared, right? It goes deep. They ask all the detailed questions that were not covered in the New York Times. And then of course, if you finish that and you want something, I was about to say lighter, but if you want something different, I saw the Civil War movie. I liked it. I really did. I think there's various opinions online, but I thought the whole movie was like sort of start to finish was very intense. I sort of was, if you will, riveted throughout the entire thing. And it's a pretty violent movie. So if you're interested in kind of a riveting, you know, violent movie and a look at, you know, kind of chaos, check out Civil War.
I saw they have posters for that around here where there's like snipers in the Statue of Liberty Tower, and that's all it says, Civil War. And I'm like, this. I don't think this is the kind of diplomacy we want here in EU. Like, whatever's going on here.
I always wonder how, like, movies like this, like, do they play around the world, or is it sort of related? I don't know.
I think they're gonna play it here. That would be super weird if not. But okay. Yeah, odd. How about yourself, Matt Ray? What do you have to recommend?
Well, flying over here, I had to do quite a bit of travel. The guy who sat down next to me on the flight from Sydney to LAX, he was like, "What is this? Like an 8-hour flight?" And I was like, "It's 15." So he had his phone, so he was good. But they did have some movies for him. My picks are both travel related. The first is, last time I was in Austin, I'd lost my eye mask, and I had, some fancy one that the wire cutter had recommended, and I needed one for my trip. And I went into HEB and just bought like the HEB one that they had. And it turns out it was really good. It's not like the free ones that you get, when you're flying overseas, but surprisingly good, and like $3.95 or something. I put a link in the show notes there. And my other pick was something that I got as a Christmas present. I don't know if it was meant to be a joke or not, but it's the ostrich pillow, which it's this, like, well, I've got it here, for those of you watching at home. It's like a, it's essentially like a big round pillow that you stick over your head while you're traveling.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it looks kind of ridiculous, but it works, because when you're sleeping on a plane, you like lean your head against something, sure. And you get like it's a pillow that sticks to your head. What more do you need?
I'm gonna describe it as a donut you put around your eyes and face. That's kind of what I enjoy.
Yeah. Well, I mix it with my HEB eye mask, and just wear it over the top of my head, so it's like a keeps me from getting too sore a neck. Works better than the neck pillow, as long as you have something to lean on.
As a friend, I mean this as a friend, I think you may travel too much that you own these things. But they're good. They look good. These recommendations look good, but I'm a little worried.
They're solid.
I'm a little worried. You definitely field tested this. You should write the next Wirecutter review. You could. I think you've done your homework on this.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of a scam are all those neck pillow things? I think I've owned.
I've had
like
a couple
five
of different
of them.
Ones. Yeah.
Like I don't even. It's like I feel like the people who do them, they're not even trying. Like all you need, like, it feels like maybe it's like it's just you would have to custom fit it, but they're basically turn into like the firmness of like a napkin when you use them.
They're not and great.
I don't know. Seems weird. You know, the thing that I think would be helpful sometimes is like if you had something that would like hold your legs together while you're sleeping, like a little clip. That you would have, because like that will mess you all up too.
Well, you just tuck the blanket around your legs.
Okay. Yeah. See, that could work. See? All right. Well, my recommendation, I've got two. One, I've been doing some little video stuff, and my daughter, I was going to give her my old phone. I've told this story, but I've actually been using the continuity camera a lot in my video stuff, and it's rock solid. More or less, like once you actually get it to hook up, like a lot of Apple things, like it works great, and then it's not working, and there's not actually anywhere to go to tell it to like reboot. You just sort of like got to go get a sandwich and come back and see if it's decided to participate.
Right.
But like it's very weird that there's no like button that's like continuity camera on and off, so it's kind of a mystery. But other than that, it works out pretty well. And then also, every Wednesday down at the square or whatever you would want to call it here, there's a not every day, but there's four wagons that come. You got a bread wagon, you got a chicken wagon, and you got a fish wagon, and those rotate throughout the days of the week. And on Wednesday, it's the fish wagon, and there's this Dutch thing. I probably mentioned it, but it's called kibbeling, K-I-B-B-E-L-I-N-G, kibbeling. And now, if you were to look at it, you would be like, oh, it's like fried fish nuggets, but it's like something entirely different. It's got different seasoning. It's got a different type of crisp to it. And it's it's like a great little Dutch delicacy. So if you're ever around here, get some kibbeling. It's great stuff. And it's not too expensive. I think I probably ate like 400 grams of it today, which I don't really know what that means, but it was heavy. So speaking of things that are heavy, it's been great that you've listened to this entire podcast. This has been episode 463. We mentioned our Slack channel here and there, all sorts of people saying interesting things, or at least some of them. If you want to join that Slack community, you can go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/463 see how to do it. You can see links to things we talked about, things we didn't, and click on those. And with that, we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's better to go into this video blind than it is to do that. But maybe, I don't know, if you will, give us like a director's cut. Don't reveal too much about it. Just sort of like what went into, making this video.
Well, when you make a video like this, I say as if I make a lot of them. Mm-hmm. Like one, you know, you got to plan ahead, which is something I don't do a lot of right now. But now that I'm saying that, you only have to plan ahead with the concept. And then the great thing about it, about my lack of planning ahead, is that you can actually do one part of the video. And as you're editing that part, you can do the second part. And it all just kind of comes together there. Which I think works out well. Now the other thing that I think is handy is it's fun to think about, like, if you're going to craft these different different points kind
of
in time.
Kind of took like a current event, right?
Yeah,
I think was the basis of it. But then you kind of, if you will, kind of interject. Right. Sort of like it's told a little bit out of order. Right. If you will.
And
a little out of order, but it's a cool way it was done. Go ahead.
I think what you have to do is whenever you when this doesn't happen, it's considered a treat. But with such a short thing, like, you've got to somehow offset that it's from a different timeline. And then that can become part of the little joke there. Now, the other thing I want to say is, like, it is surprisingly hard to find, 80s news and commercial transition stingers. So if you've ever looked for those, it's, because I got them in my head, like what they sound like, you know, like dun dun dun, or like all these little things. But like, woof, I don't even know what to type in to find those sounds, right? And of course, you got to find ones that you can use for free that say royalty free or whatever. But
right. The
problem is, like, all the free sources I have in, like, you know, from Adobe and from Descript, they all, like, you can tell it's just, I mean, no, what do they say? No shade, no lemonade or whatever, but like, good job. But it's all just like some person using GarageBand making some synth thing, but you really need that, like, you know.
Yeah, you need some, yeah, start.
The real stuff. All
right, well, listen, I've listed, I don't know, I feel like this heading doesn't do it justice, but I've gone ahead and put this as the only item that's linked under nonsense, because it's sort of like, it's really not nonsense. It's like, I don't know. Maybe it's nonsense and not ironic. What, Cote, should I give it a different header? What header should I give it so that people looking at the show notes right now, they can actually click on the link?
I think it's enterprise nonsense.
Enterprise nonsense? Okay, I'm going to change it to, so go to the enterprise nonsense section of the show notes, or if for some reason, you know, you're using a podcast player that doesn't, just go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/463 and then click on the link and give Cote some YouTube love, and I think you'll enjoy it though. If you don't enjoy it, we don't want to hear any feedback. We don't want positive vibes here. We only want positive vibes. We're not looking for a critical analysis of this. We're just looking for you to enjoy it for a few minutes. So well done, Cote.